From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
If confirmed, I recognize that I will have a tremendous responsibility to keep our judicial system strong and to help ensure that the courts meet their obligations to strictly apply the laws and the Constitution.
President Bush nominates former personal lawyer and confidant Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. Anti-choice Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid praises the decision.
But Harriet Myers has served with distinction as a trial lawyer. That's what I am. I'm a trial lawyer. So anyone with that background makes me feel good.
We'll speak with former presidential candidate Ralph Nader.
When the Democrats' leader in the Senate, Senate Harry Reid, in effect puts his stamp of approval on her, that fulfills the Republican strategy of splitting the Democrats before a couple hours passed yesterday. And that doesn't augur well for a very thorough examination of what her positions and what her record is over the years.
And on the Iraq front, retired U.S. General William Odom, former head of the National Security Agency, asks, what's wrong with cutting and running? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second time in a week, a Texas grand jury has indicted Tom DeLay, the influential Republican lawmaker who up until last week served as House Majority Leader. On Monday, DeLay was indicted for money laundering. If convicted, he could be sentenced to life in prison. DeLay is accused of illegally funneling $190,000 in corporate campaign contributions to local candidates. Last week, a different grand jury indicted him for conspiracy. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has confirmed the Justice Department has asked British police to question former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher over a 2,000 meeting she had with DeLay that was organized by Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Abramoff, who DeLay has called one of his closest and dearest friends, is the target of a separate wide-ranging Justice Department investigation for corruption. According to the New York Times, the interview request of Thatcher is the first publicly disclosed evidence from the Justice Department that DeLay was under scrutiny in the Abramoff investigation. Questions are being raised over President Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers as Supreme Court Justice because of her lack of judicial experience and her close ties to the president. The 60-year-old Myers has been in Bush's inner circle for a decade, first as his personal attorney in Texas, later as White House counsel. In the hours after Bush's announcement, some of the strongest criticism of Myers came from conservatives. Weekly Standard editor William Kristol said he was disappointed, depressed, and demoralized by the selection, which he says hints of cronyism. Vice President Dick Cheney took to the conservative airwaves to make the case for Myers on Sean Hannity's radio show. Cheney vowed she would fit the mold of Justice Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Legal Times described her as a devout churchgoer. She was raised Catholic but is now a member of a church whose ministers describe it as, quote, conservative, Bible-based evangelical. Meanwhile, Democrat Harry Reid, the Senate minority leader, appeared side by side with Myers and praised her qualifications. Last week, during a conference call with bloggers, Reid reportedly announced he had asked President Bush to consider Myers for the job. Myers has never served as judge. Her stance on many pressing issues remains unknown. As president of the Texas State Bar, she led an unsuccessful fight to get the American Bar Association to reconsider its pro-abortion rights stance. This marks the first time since 1971 a president nominated someone without judicial experience to serve on the Supreme Court. If confirmed, Myers will become the third ever female justice. We'll have more on her nomination in a few minutes. In Iraq, the U.S. has launched its second major offensive in the past 4 days in western Iraq. About 2,500 Marines, soldiers, and sailors, as well as hundreds of Iraqi troops, took part in what is being called Operation Rivergate. Bridges across the Euphrates River between Haqqaniyah and Haditha were bombed to prevent insurgents from using them. The Associated Press reports this is the largest U.S. offensive of the year in the Anbar province, a Sunni stronghold. On Saturday, about 1,000 U.S. troops launched launched a separate offensive near the Syrian border. Meanwhile, Sunni leaders are threatening to boycott the October 15th vote on the Constitution after Iraqi leaders changed the rules for ratification that'll make it almost impossible for the Constitution to be rejected. Under the new rules, the Constitution will fail only if two-thirds of all registered voters reject it in at least three of the 18 provinces. Originally, the Constitution could have been defeated if two-thirds of all those actually casting ballots rejected it in three provinces. Sunni leaders are accusing the Shiite leadership of fixing the vote on the Constitution. One secular Sunni lawmaker, Adnan al-Janabi, said, quote, "This is a mockery of democracy, a mockery of law. Many Sunnis have been telling me they didn't believe in this democratic process, and now I believe they're vindicated," he said. The rules were changed on Sunday during an unannounced vote in Parliament. In Gaza City, over three dozen Palestinian police officers broke into the Palestinian Parliament building to protest a lack of bullets and proper equipment. Monday's protest came one day after members of Hamas attacked a police station with assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. Three people died, including a deputy police chief, and 50 were injured in the bloodiest fighting between Hamas and the police in Gaza in over a decade. Human Rights Watch is demanding Louisiana officials investigate reports that prisoners evacuated from the Jefferson Parish prison due to Hurricane Katrina were beaten and mistreated after they were taken to the Jenna Correctional Facility. Prisoners have told Human Rights Watch that prisoners' correctional officers have beaten, kicked, and hit them while they were shackled. They also say officers sprayed the walls with chemicals and forced prisoners to hold their faces against the sprayed walls. When some prisoners became ill and vomited, officers wiped their faces and hair in the vomit, they charge. Corinne Carey of Human Rights Watch said, quote, "It appears that men who have been through the horrors of Katrina were then subjected to new horrors at the hands of prison officers." In Haiti, at least two journalists have been beaten by bodyguards of the country's interim president, Boniface Alexander. According to the Associated Press, the bodyguards were American employees of the private security firm DimeCor. The company has been contracted by the U.S. State Department to protect Alexander, the unelected interim president of Haiti. Alexander took power after the coup that toppled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The journalists were beaten as they tried to cover a ceremony marking the reopening of the courts after the summer holidays. Police said the journalists arrived late and then tried to force their way into the building. The Justice Department confirmed Monday that it'll investigate the FBI killing of Puerto Rican independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios. The killing has sparked widespread outrage in Puerto Rico. On September 23rd, over 100 FBI agents surrounded the house of the 72-year-old Ojeda Rios. After he was shot, the FBI let him lie wounded in his house for nearly a day, during which time he bled to death. The FBI claimed Ojeda Rios fired first, but his wife said, "This isn't true." Ojeda Rios had been on the FBI's most wanted list for his role, they charge, in a $7 million bank heist. But he was a legendary figure in Puerto Rico for his lifelong resistance to U.S. colonialism. Tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans attended his funeral services last week. The Senate Intelligence Committee has approved new legislation that would allow Pentagon intelligence operatives to collect information from U.S. citizens without revealing their status as government spies. According to the Los Angeles Times, the bill would end a longstanding requirement that military intelligence officers disclose their government ties when approaching any U.S. citizen in the United States. And at least 460 undocumented immigrants have died over the past year trying to cross the Mexican-U.S. border, a 20% increase over the previous year. Border Patrol said most of the deaths occurred along the Arizona-Mexico border. And that's some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush reached into his inner circle, nominated Harriet Myers, his White House counsel and former personal attorney, to the Supreme Court Monday.
I believe the senators of both parties will find that Harriet Myers' talent, experience, and judicial philosophy make her a superb choice to safeguard the constitutional liberties and equality of all Americans. Harriet Myers will strictly interpret our Constitution and laws. She will not legislate from the bench. I ask the Senate to review her qualifications thoroughly and fairly and to vote on her nomination promptly.
In nominating Harriet Myers, President Bush turned to a lawyer with no judicial experience or constitutional background to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and help shape the nation's judiciary. This marks the first time since 71 a president nominated someone without judicial experience to serve on the Supreme Court. If confirmed, Myers will become the third woman to ever serve on the court. She spoke after President Bush announced her nomination.
If confirmed, I recognize that I will have a tremendous responsibility to keep our judicial system strong and to help ensure that the courts meet their obligations to strictly apply the laws and the Constitution.
Harriet Myers is 60 years old. After earning her undergraduate and law degrees from Southern Methodist University, she worked as a corporate litigator in Dallas at the firm now known as Locke, Liddell & Sapp. She would rise to become the first woman to head a major Dallas law firm and was named one of the 100 most powerful lawyers in the country. She specialized in commercial litigation, representing big-name clients like Microsoft and Disney Corporation. Myers later rose to become the first woman to serve as president of the Texas State Bar and the Dallas Bar Association. She met George W. Bush in the 80s. She was counsel for his 1994 campaign for governor. She continued on as Bush's personal attorney until he appointed her to head the Texas Lottery Commission. She helped recruit conservative lawyers for Bush during the Florida recount in 2000 and was reportedly assigned during the campaign to conduct a review of his National Guard service. She followed Bush to the White House, where she served as White House Deputy Chief of Staff as well as Staff Secretary, a job in which she reviewed virtually every document that went before the president. In 2004, she was tapped to become White House counsel. Her relationship is so close to President Bush that White House insiders joked to the Los Angeles Times she was his, quote, work wife. Bush once called her, quote, a pit bull in size six shoes. As White House counsel, Myers vetted judicial nominees, including newly installed Chief Justice John Roberts. She also advised the president on issues including the CIA leak investigation and the role of torture in the fight against terrorism. Without a judicial record, it may be difficult for senators to know where Myers stands on key issues facing the court. What is known is that a city council candidate, as one in Dallas, she opposed the repeal of a law against gay sex. In 92, when delegates to a National American Bar Association convention adopted a position in favor of abortion rights, Myers worked as head of the Texas State Bar to force a reconsideration of the issue by submitting it to a referendum by the 360,000-person membership. And as President Bush's White House lawyer, she helped vet deeply conservative judges. Some of the strongest criticism of her nomination has come from conservatives. A number of them have come out against her nomination to the bench. Rush Limbaugh called the nomination a sign of, quote, weakness. Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol said he was, quote, disappointed, depressed, and demoralized by the selection. Meanwhile, Democrat Harry Reid, the Senate minority leader, appeared side by side with Myers soon after a nomination and praised her qualifications.
But Harriet Myers has served with distinction as a trial lawyer. That's what I am. I'm a trial lawyer. So anyone with that background makes me feel good.
Last week, during a conference call with bloggers, the anti-choice Democrat, Harry Reid, reportedly announced he'd ask President Bush to consider Myers for the job. Myers is a former Democrat who once contributed campaign donations to Al Gore and Lloyd Benson. Since 1988, all her contributions have gone to the Republican Party. New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer said he'll push for documents on Myers and pressure her to answer questions about her judicial philosophy.
As I said, we know less about Harriet Myers than we knew about John Roberts. And there are two ways to find out what her judicial philosophy is. Her past record, and, you know, her record as lottery commissioner isn't going to tell us very much. So it would be the time she served in the White House, although it was rather small. But if there ever was a time when the hearings are going to make a huge difference, it's now.
We're joined now on the telephone by former independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Over the last few months, he has been writing Harriet Myers a series of letters. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Thank you, Amy.
What have you been writing to Harriet Myers?
Well, we're trying to find out whether Karl Rove, during the 2004 election, obeyed federal law and properly allocated the time he spent in the White House on political activity, the resources he spent in the White House on political activity, from his taxpayer-funded role as special assistant to the president, performing duties that are well-defined. And we can't get an answer. We wrote her, Harriet Myers, that is, in March, asking for an allocation to be made public, if there was an allocation, and there was no answer. We wrote her on the 18th of July, and there was no answer. And today I'm writing President Bush, asking that that allocation be made public, and if there is no allocation, what is his explanation under federal law? The performance by Harriet Mears on this matter is not trivial. Karl Rove was the architect of President Bush's reelection campaign. Those were the very words that President Bush used on the celebration after the election last November. And here we have the counsel to the president, Harriet Myers, a nominee to the Supreme Court of the United States, refusing to answer a simple letter that basically says, did Karl Rove obey federal law, 5 U.S.C. 7321, and have a accounting separating his duties in the White House in terms of time and resources? And if so, make it public. No answer.
We're talking to Ralph Nader, who wrote Harriet Myers a series of letters, got no response, asking, should Karl Rove resign? Did you raise the issue of the exposing of Valerie Plame?
No, I just focused completely on the federal law that requires certain officials in the federal government, cabinet secretaries, as well as White House special assistants, to separate his or her time in terms of times and resources spent on elections or political activity and the time spent, in effect, as in public service. You know, Amy, in the Congress, if a staff member of a senator or representative engages in political activity during election time, that person can be prosecuted. So that's why staff members of Congress, people, take a leave of absence. They drop their public salary, and they go out and push for the reelection of their senator or representative. But unfortunately, a number of years ago, the Democrats and the Republicans got together in the Congress and said, we're going to make an exception from that law for the executive branch, for cabinet officials and for top White House officials. But that exemption required that accounting be established, clearly delineating the time, for example, Karl Rove spent in the White House making calls to reelect Bush or spending materials and resources to reelect Bush, and the time he spent on government business as special assistant to the president. He didn't do that. And so Harriet Myers is, in effect, by not answering those letters, is covering up for Karl Rove. And if the Democrats don't raise that issue in the confirmation hearings, they will continue their record as a whole, with some luminous exceptions, but as a whole, of being a party that is spineless, gutless, hapless, clueless, and now leaderless. Imagine, within minutes of the nomination yesterday, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, Senator Harry Reid from Nevada, in effect put his imprimatur of approval on Harriet Myers. And then he met with her and said even kinder things. Now, that means that Republicans have instantly split the Democrats and are on their way to another confirmation.
Well, in fact, last week during a conference call with bloggers, Reid reportedly announced he'd asked President Bush to consider Harriet Myers for the job.
Yes, that further undermines the Democrat position.
Do you think it has to do with the Senate Minority Leader, the leading Democrat in the Senate, Harry Reid, being anti-choice?
That could be a factor, but I think a larger factor is the game that the Republicans are playing with the Democrats. They threaten to appoint a Genghis Khan-type person. The Democrats are very relieved that a Genghis Khan-type person is not nominated to the Supreme Court. The whole de-escalation of expectation levels keeps going down, and that's what you got yesterday. You got statements of caution from Senator Kennedy saying, well, let's wait and see. And you have statements like that of Senator Reid. I mean, they are really in disarray. On the Roberts nomination, for example, Senator Reid came out against Judge Roberts, and Senator Leahy, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, Senator Reid doesn't speak for the Democratic caucus. He just speaks for himself. And then Senator Leahy turns around and votes for Judge Roberts. But when Senator Reid said he was against Judge Roberts, he said at the same time that the half of the Democrats are going to vote for Judge Roberts. I mean, what kind of leadership is that? When you undermine your position that you've just taken against a Supreme Court nominee by saying, well, half of my Democrats are going to be voting for Judge Roberts. So the Democrats are really in total disarray, not just on this subject, but on the war in Iraq, on reviving national health insurance, universal health insurance, on getting a living wage, on standing up for the civil justice system, of compensating wrongful injury, of going after the bloated military budget, and going after the huge allocation of tax dollars for corporate subsidies, handouts, and giveaways that take money away from the necessities of the American people, and things like what happened that made the southern states so vulnerable during the hurricane, the whole lack of adequate modern public works establishment. So,
Ralph Nader, we're going to break, and then when we come back, we'll also be joined by Ronald Cass, who is co-chair of the Committee for Justice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with retired General William Odom. He says the U.S. should cut and run from Iraq. But right now, we're continuing to talk about President Bush's selection of Harriet Myers as Supreme Court Justice. We're joined by former independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader and Ronald Cass, co-chair of the Committee for Justice, former dean of Boston University Law School. We welcome you to Democracy Now! From Washington. Your response to President Bush's nomination?
Well, President Bush has said consistently that he would be putting people on the court who shared his sense that judges should be guided by the text and history of the Constitution. They should be reading and applying the laws and not saying what they think personally are good values. Harriet Myers has been deeply engaged with the president in selecting judges who fit that mold. She's given us a series of judges who are highly qualified, who do respect the law and the Constitution, and I expect that she will fit that mold herself. The emphasis on judicial experience seems to me very misplaced. We've had quite a few judges in the history of the Supreme Court who had no judicial experience previously. You mentioned William Rehnquist. The list also includes Earl Warren, Felix Frankfurter, Louis Brandeis, Harlan Fiske-Stone, John Marshall, and a number of the greats of the court. So I think he's made a choice of somebody he knows and trusts and values, who by all accounts should be a very sound and solid justice.
I wanted to ask what you think of other conservatives' comments. David Gergen said he was startled. He said Harriet Myers is well-educated Methodist, but when you look at her credentials, the thinnest of any nominee we've seen in decades, if not a half century. He said she's never worked in constitutional law, doesn't know anything about it, a stealth candidate. He said if you look at her record in the White House, she came in as staff secretary. Her highest position in Texas was head of the Lottery Commission, not ordinarily springboards for the Supreme Court. Pat Buchanan said Myers' qualifications for court are non-existent. And, of course, William Kristol said he's disappointed, depressed, and demoralized, said her selection will be judged as a combination of cronyism and capitulation on the part of the president. Your response, Ronald Cass?
First of all, a lot of judges who have a track record as judges were obviously being considered for this, and a lot of us who know them and admire them thought a great many of them would be very good Supreme Court justices. That doesn't mean that Harriet Myers isn't also going to be a very good Supreme Court justice. She was the president of the bar in Texas. She was the head of one of the leading law firms there. She's been active in the American Bar Association. She's not only served as a corporate attorney, which is something that will help broaden the spectrum of views on the Supreme Court, but also she has seen for a number of years everything going across the president's desk in the White House, which certainly gives her a perspective on events in government that very few people share. This is somebody who has a wealth of experience. It's not the typical experience for the court, but we've had over history quite a few people come from backgrounds that don't replicate those of the current justices, and they've served with distinction and made a real impact on the court and on the law.
Quick question, and that is her stance on abortion, getting the American Bar Association, not to take a stand against abortion, but at least not to take one for abortion, to be neutral on the issue. Do you take heart from that?
Well, many people in the American Bar Association, both those who are pro-life and those who are pro-choice, thought the Bar Association made a dreadful mistake in getting involved in the issue and getting involved not on any technical legal ground, but on the ground of sharing the value that was pro-abortion. That's not the sort of position a Bar Association should take. The Bar Association has no special standing to say whether Americans should or should not promote more or less abortions. The Bar Association has competence on legal, technical questions. This wasn't one of them. And she was clearly right that this wasn't something the Bar Association should be adopting a resolution on.
Some are writing about a comparison between the head of FEMA, Michael Brown, who President Bush called Brownie and said, "You're doing a heck of a job," and Harriet Myers saying that she just has a lack of credentials but is clearly close to the president. Yours?
Well, clearly Harriet Myers is close to the president. He's worked with her for a long time. He knows her well. We've seen he's consistently said he values judges on the courts who will read the text of the Constitution, who will apply it, who won't make up their own views of what the Constitution should be. Obviously, Harriet Myers shares those views, shares those values, shares that sense of judicial conservatism, and the president has confidence in her. The Constitution's designed to give the president the power to make these nominations and appointments, and a heavy presumption in favor of the president's selections. I think both in terms of the history and structure of the Constitution and the sense of what this president stands for, people should look at this and say, we trust the president. He's made a selection of somebody he knows well. He's told us what he stands for, and he's consistently promoted judges who fit that model. I expect Harriet Myers will as well.
Ralph Nader.
It's not a matter of trust, as the former dean of Boston University Law School should know. It's a matter of public examination and evaluation, and not just by the public at large, but by the constitutionally invested U.S. Senate. Providing advice and consent. And what President Bush has done is appoint as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, a confidant whose record is going to be confidential, because all the memos she wrote to him, her advice to him as governor of Texas, his advice to Bush as president, all the paperwork is all going to be confidential. So here you have the spectacle where a nation full of jurists and law professors and lawyers who could provide the talent and experience and a record for open examination being shoved aside, and the president is appointing a confidant whose record is confidential. Now, if the Senate does not rise to that challenge, that itself sets a very, very dubious precedent. It's not a matter of trusting the president. It's a matter of revealing to millions of Americans in open hearings what her positions are, what she advised, what she stood for, what she stood against on the momentous issues before the president of the United States. And you can be sure that the White House is going to say that's confidential. In fact, she was part of the president's coterie, which insisted that the memos written by Judge Roberts when he was in the Solicitor General's office in the Justice Department were confidential and could not be given to the Senate.
Well, as the White House counsel, she rejected that request. Ronald Cass, your response.
I think that when Mr. Nader talks about setting a precedent by not fully examining her positions, he's getting things just totally backwards. The precedent for 200 years has been that we don't know all the personal positions of judges who go to the Supreme Court, and we don't need to. We shouldn't. We don't want to be trying to predict what their personal positions are, because they're supposed to be guided by the law. They're not supposed to be guided by their personal views. For 175 years, nobody came before the Senate Judiciary Committee to answer questions because it was considered improper. When Judge Roberts sat before the committee and said, I'm not going to tell you how I would decide certain things. I'm not going to tell you my own values. I'm going to tell you how I look at the law. He was doing exactly the right thing. That's what judges do. They look at the law. They decide cases. We don't want searching inquiries into their personal values, and we don't want to try to pin down their positions in advance of hearing the case, seeing the arguments, having a specific context for making a decision.
Well, it's impossible to separate a person's judgment and values from their judicial work. I mean, that's just a legal fiction, and Judge Roberts should have known that. That was one of the more foolish things he said. That's why there are such widely differing positions between people like Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer, and on the one hand, say, and positions of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas on the other. It's not because they have a different linguistic reading of cases before them. It's because they come with a philosophy, they come with a value system that moves right in to their deliberative processes. And we have a right to know what Ms. Myers has been thinking all these years. Where does she stand on due process, for example? Where does she stand on separation of powers? Where does she stand on the Santa Clara case in the 19th century that declared a corporation to be a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment? So, I mean, why have hearings? Why have advice and consent if it's nothing more than sort of a rubber stamp automated process shorn of all values and philosophy?
Ronald Cass, co-chair of the Committee for Justice.
The process has traditionally been one that hasn't looked at personal values. It hasn't inquired into them. It's asked about the competence of the person. What the constitutional design is that the president nominates and appoints. The Senate is a check against appointment of incompetent people, people who don't have the temperament to sit on the court. They don't have any capacity to tell what people are going to do on the court. They don't have a capacity to predict how somebody is going to decide important cases. And in fact, what does matter isn't the personal value. It's whether somebody takes the role of judge seriously, is somebody who looks at the legal authorities and is guided by them, is relatively modest in their view of what judges do, or relatively expansive. And the president has said he wants people who are modest about the role of judges. Harriet Myers has helped him pick judges who fit that mold. It's the mold I expect she'll fit, and I think it's the right mold.
Well, Mr. Cass, those assertions of yours are properly subjected to examination by the Senate. You don't take it as an article of faith. You take it as a proposition or a assertion to be examined in open public hearings before millions of Americans. And secondly, what about the way she did her job? It has nothing to do, say, with what cases she's going to decide. For example, not responding to public inquiries about Karl Rove not separating, not providing an accounting or not making an accounting public, separating his political activity and expenditures in the White House from his duties as special assistant. I mean, that's fair game, isn't it, to see what kind of job she did as counsel to the president? Is she covering up for Karl Rove and other many other matters that she was involved in as a advisor to the president?
Ronald Cass, you have the last word on that one.
Well, the Senate can clearly ask her what her philosophy is. It can ask her how she views the job of judging. It can look at what she has done over time. I'm not going to see what her correspondence looks like with Mr. Nader. I'm sure she has a lot of things to do, but by all accounts, she's had a very successful career in a number of different arenas and comes to the job with a wealth of experience for it.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow President Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. This is Democracy Now! Our guests have been Ronald Cass, co-chair of the Committee for Justice and former dean of Boston University Law School, as well as Ralph Nader, former independent presidential candidate. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, and PBS stations, on public access TV and low-power FM stations. We're podcasting at democracynow.org, where our headlines are also in Spanish, in audio and in transcript, as is our whole program. As we turn now to Iraq, what's wrong with cutting and running? That's the question asked by retired Army General William Odom about the continued U.S. military presence in Iraq. Odom served as director of the National Security Agency, that top secret agency, well larger than the CIA under President Reagan. He served as Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, the Army Senior Intelligence Officer, now Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. He recently wrote, quote, "The invasion of Iraq will turn out to be the greatest strategic disaster in U.S. history." In his article, Odom says the wisest course for journalists might be to begin sustained investigations of why leading Democrats have failed so miserably to challenge the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The first step, of course, is to establish as conventional wisdom the fact that the war was never in the U.S. interest and has not become so, he writes. Lieutenant General William Odom joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't you lay out your argument? A general calling for cutting and running?
Well, I'm trying to think like a strategist. And in war, as well as in politics and diplomacy, one has to know when to withdraw and when to attack. And this was a misguided attack, and it requires a strategic vision and the moral confidence to turn it around. The earlier the better, but as the evidence piles up, I think my judgment is being borne out. Now, I said before the war in February that if we invade Iraq, this will serve primarily the interest of two people, Osama bin Laden, because it'll make Iraq safe for al-Qaeda, and it will allow him to have access to kill Americans, which he cannot do in the U.S. very effectively. The second party that would benefit greatly would be the Iranians. Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, and they fought for 8 years. And the Iranians hated that regime as much or more than we did. Therefore, it was very much in their interest. And it's clear now that a Shiite majority will probably end up in control in Iraq. And it will not be pro-American, and it probably will be an Islamic religious republic. So that's those kinds of outcomes were foreseeable. And then I didn't say anything about it for a year and pointed out that exactly these things are happening. that I was asked about in August whether I thought the journalists were doing a good job in pressing this issue with the president. And the answers you've just read are the ones I gave.
Now, you wrote this piece. It's appearing a bit on the internet and some local papers, but you offered it to the New York Times as an op-ed piece?
I didn't offer this exact version. I offered a draft op-ed. This is considerably longer than would be accepted as an op-ed.
But the idea was to call for cutting and writing.
I said exactly. It's not just.
Have you gotten
out and the earlier the better. The idea of staying the course makes no sense at all.
Have you gotten other op-ed pieces printed in the Times?
Maybe 15 or 20, maybe 30 in the past 10 years.
What did they say about this one?
Well, they didn't say this. Just didn't take it.
Why do you think that is?
I really don't know. Maybe they just overlooked it. Maybe they didn't think my writing style was up to previous standards. I think the message would have been worth them. If they didn't like the structure of the piece, asked me to trim it or edit it. But I really don't know. There's a tendency, it seems to me, among both Democrats and Republicans to really get nervous about doing anything here. They know that we're in trouble, and they're just not willing to face up to the reality that we are going to have to one day pick up and leave, and that you are almost, as I said in the piece, the structure of this piece essentially is saying that all the things the administration says will happen if we leave are already happening, or they're irrelevant.
So you say the arguments against pulling out, we'd leave behind a civil war, we'd lose credibility on the world stage, it would embolden the insurgency and cripple the move toward democracy, Iraq would become a haven for terrorists, Iranian influence in Iraq would increase, unrest might spread in the region and or draw in Iraq's neighbors, Shiite-Sunni clashes would worsen, we haven't fully trained the Iraqi military and police forces yet, and talk of deadlines would undercut the morale of our troops. You say all of this has already happened.
Sure. The fact, I mean, just take the last one. You can see from the exchanges over the training of troops that went up to the Congress the other day when General Abizaid and General Casey both gave a rather dismal picture of progress in training up units that can fight on their own in the Iraqi forces. They said only one, Rumsfeld, previously had, within a day or two before, had told Congress that three and the number was surging, and, you know, he gave a very rosy picture, and they were much more cautious. Now they've been turned around, and they are up on the Sunday morning news shows this week saying, well, things are rosier. It's clear that they themselves are dubious about this. They cannot afford to stand up and contradict the regime, rather the administration, too forcefully. I think they can say some of the facts fairly clearly and without any edge if they can avoid it. But, you know, the judgments out there are not good. And I've heard from many junior officers the view that, yes, we're winning tactically. Our unit wins every tactical battle. But the big picture, the strategic picture, we're losing. They kill one of us for every 1,000 we kill. They have over 20 million people. We have 123,000. You know, the numbers are just against us. And once one begins to look at it objectively like that, you've got to ask what this is worth. What do you gain by doing this?
Do you think ultimately this is what will happen? It'll just be a matter of years?
Oh, yeah. Look, that's what happened in Vietnam. I mean, I for different reasons, I had a similar view in Vietnam. By the way, the troops don't mind you debating the issue back here. I mean, I was in Vietnam. A lot of us wondered why there wasn't more debate. We wondered why mainstream people were not debating it, and they let the fringe left anti-war movement blame us, blame people in uniform. I went over and spoke the other day. You know, I don't have politics right or left. I've never been a Republican or Democrat. And I've worked in the Carter White House, and I've worked in the Reagan White House, and I'm partisan. This is not a partisan politics issue. Congressman Walter Jones, who can hardly be called a conservative. Liberal is a very conservative Republican from North Carolina who invented the term freedom fries to replace the French fries label, has now enrolled a resolution to Congress calling for our withdrawal. And I was surprised to get calls from him asking me to come over and attend a small press conference that he has, where he has a small group of Republicans and an equal number of Democrats behind this. And the point I made, the only reason I went and joined them was that I'd rather see people on the on Bush's side and responsible mainline Democrats carry this issue than let it go out to the fringes, and that's where it's headed.
Lieutenant General William Odom, I want to thank you for being with us, and I hope we can continue to talk about this in the coming weeks. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Lieutenant General William Odom served as director of the National Security Agency under President Reagan. He's now at the Hudson Institute in Washington. When we come back, a discussion about what happens to the kids of Mississippi and Louisiana. Stay with us. Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The images broadcast all over the world in the days after the Hurricane Katrina disaster forced some politicians to admit that poverty and endemic racial discrimination were still major problems in the U.S. Criticism about the government's slow response to the disaster mounted. President Bush gave a televised address where he promised to address racial inequality and implement plans to help the poor. Congress is now considering various plans to give relief to the victims of the disaster, including an expansion of the child tax credit, which first passed in 97. The credit's an actual reduction in taxes as opposed to just a deduction in taxable income. It allows families to reduce the federal income tax they owe by up to $500 per child per year. In 2001, President Bush extended the credit to $1,000 and made it partly available to families too poor to have income tax bills. The credit phases out at incomes above $110,000 and below $11,000, meaning the wealthiest and the poorest families receive nothing. Bush has touted the child tax credit as proof that the steep tax cuts he's implemented since he's been in office don't just benefit the wealthy, but are good for low-income families as well. But a new study by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center shows the program doesn't benefit almost half of Black and Latino children. And it turns out the children who see the least benefit from the credit are in Mississippi and Louisiana. We're joined now by David Harris, president of the Children's Research and Education Institute, and in D.C. by Dan Mitchell, an economist at the Heritage Foundation. David Harris, let's begin with you. What's your concern?
My concern here is we have what is essentially the largest child subsidy that our federal government has, about $46, $47 billion this year. And because it's designed to work through the tax code, we leave about over a quarter of all children out, including half of African-American children and close to half of Latino or Hispanic children as well.
And specifically in Mississippi and Louisiana?
Well, if you look at the poverty numbers for Mississippi and Louisiana and where they line up relative to the other 48 states, you see them at the top of the list. And so the concern is, I mean, what Katrina did was really is opened the country's eyes to poverty, put poverty on television. And here you have a situation where the largest child subsidy really overlooks a large number of children, the vast majority in working families.
Dan Mitchell, you are the Heritage Foundation's chief expert on tax policy and the economy. Do you agree?
Well, I agree that if you have a tax cut, it's not going to benefit people who don't earn enough income to pay taxes. That's why I thought the Tax Policy Center study was about as remarkable as saying the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. If you don't pay taxes, when there's a tax cut, you're not going to be among the beneficiaries. The problems we have in Louisiana and Mississippi and other low-income communities around the world is we have generations of poverty that have been subsidized by a $6 trillion war on poverty that has massively failed because we have, in effect, destroyed the family by having the government come in and play mommy and daddy. Those are the problems we need to deal with. We need to deal with them through things like school choice, where you can help people break out of poverty. But these are the very things that the left are viciously fighting because they put the interest of teachers' unions ahead of the interest of black children.
Dan Mitchell, or rather David Harris.
Well, this really isn't an issue about left or right. I mean, you have Olympia Snow coming out saying, Senator Olympia Snow, Republican of Maine, coming out saying we should do something about this. Former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, saying Congress should address this. This is really about which kids are included. Our country's decided to have a child tax credit. Came out of the contract with America in 1994, passed in 97, and expanded by President Bush. President Bush has said we should expand the child credit in 2003. And so here we have a credit that's $47 billion. And what we're saying is that perhaps the waitress should also be, the child of a waitress should also be getting $1,000 credit that the people she serves gets.
But how do you give a tax cut to people who don't pay taxes? That's income redistribution. Do you want to make America more like France with double-digit unemployment and economic stagnation?
I don't believe it's French to say that leaving out half of African-American children, half of Hispanic children, over a quarter of all children, the vast majority in working families, from the child credit. That's seems to me it's an issue of fair of right and wrong.
How do you give a tax cut to people who don't pay taxes?
These are people who are paying significant payroll, state and local taxes. And because we've designed the child credit through the tax code, have essentially been left out of it.
Dan Mitchell.
I still come back to the first thing I said. If we have a tax cut, the child tax credit, how are you going to give that to people who don't earn enough income to pay taxes? In effect, what's being said here is that we should turn a tax credit into a form of income redistribution, and that is making America more like France or some of the high-tax European welfare states that have such economic misery and double-digit unemployment. We don't want to go down that road. We want opportunity. We want job creation. We want better economic performance, and those aren't the things you get through income redistribution. We've had $6 trillion in the war on poverty, and it's created the problems in New Orleans. It doesn't solve them. Government is the problem, not the answer.
This is a program that we have that's $47 billion a year, and when you look at who doesn't get the full credit, you're talking many of the families of the armed services, in addition to waitresses and home health workers. And the question is, if we're going to have a child credit, and we've decided to have one, came out of the contract with America and expanded by President Bush, if we're going to have one, it seems to me that we should be including, looking at these other families who are working, playing by the rules, and who also have kids with needs.
Well, what you're really saying is you want to turn the tax credit into just a form of government payment to everybody, which would be a form of income redistribution. And again, I come back to, show me any country in the world that has ever prospered and grown and created economic opportunity by having higher taxes and more redistribution. That entire model has collapsed in the former Soviet bloc. That entire model is responsible for the economic stagnation of Western Europe. We want free markets and individual responsibility and individual opportunity here in America. I don't want to go down the route of countries that have failed because they've pursued too much income redistribution.
I wanted to expand this discussion about who benefits in this country around the issue also of bankruptcy. The Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act was passed in April and goes into effect on October 17th. Critics of the bill charge it was crafted by lobbyists for the credit card industry and that credit companies stand to reap several billion dollars in profit from the law. Meanwhile, the bill makes it harder and more expensive for people to seek bankruptcy protection. It gives lenders and businesses new legal tools for recovering debts. Four Congress members, led by Democrat John Conyers of Michigan, are calling for victims of Katrina to be exempt from certain provisions of the law. Conyers says, quote, in today's lagging economy, far too many hardworking Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, just barely getting by. And that tenuous financial condition, many families are only one tragedy away from being devastated by debt. Many of the families who've now lost their homes, livelihoods, and personal possessions will soon be contacted by credit collection collection agencies demanding the next minimum payment on a credit card. We're also joined in Washington, D.C. by Travis Plunkett, the legislative director of Consumer Federation of America. Can you talk about this?
The concern is that Katrina victims are going to be kept from a safety net program that has existed for many years. I mean, that's what bankruptcy is. This new law that takes effect on October 17th, as you said, erects a number of new barriers. Several of them are going to handcuff bankruptcy judges in considering the cause of bankruptcy. We have many Americans who file bankruptcy for legitimate reasons, mostly because they're hit by unforeseen emergencies. The natural disaster, the Katrina situation, is just an example of how people who are doing things right, who are paying their bills, are hit by unforeseen emergencies and end up in bankruptcy. The problem with this new law is that judges won't have the discretion to ease these people's paths through the bankruptcy process. The new law will require them to pay more for bankruptcy. It will require them to pay that money up front. It will require them to meet a number of new paperwork burdens and legal burdens. And all of those factors are going to keep these people from bankruptcy. Let me mention that we're not so concerned about the next few months because Katrina victims are just trying to deal with coping with day-to-day life. What the research shows is that after a natural disaster, bankruptcies don't peak for 3 years. So we're concerned about what happens next year or the year after, not necessarily in the next few months. Although I should mention there were some people on the brink of bankruptcy who have had difficulty getting into court before this new law takes effect.
Dan Mitchell of the Heritage Foundation, your response to Travis Plunkett.
Well, I'm a tax person, not a bankruptcy person, but I do know that the basic economics of bankruptcy are that if you make it too easy to declare bankruptcy, you wind up encouraging lenders, credit card companies and others, banks, to take a very dim view of extending credit to low-income people. So there's a balance here. I mean, bankruptcy law is part of our system. It enables people to get a second chance in life. But you want to make sure that there aren't a lot of people abusing it, because who pays the price for that? The people who pay the price for that are low-income people, because they're, in effect, tarnished by the irresponsible behavior of a few. And so where we strike that balance, I'll be the first to admit, that's not my area of expertise. But I know that credit card companies don't exist as charities. They want to make their rate of return just like everyone else wants to make a rate of return. And if you have a lot of people declaring bankruptcy, and if the government makes it too easy to do that, then what's going to happen? The rest of people, including low-income people who are being responsible with their finances, are going to be paying higher interest rates. They're going to find it more difficult to get credit. So where we draw the line, again, I'm not the person to answer that question, but we have to keep in mind that it is a balancing act.
Travis Plunkett, what about that?
Yeah. Well, Dan is right. It is a balance. And the concern with this law is that the balance now has been tilted too far in the direction of creditors. One of the major reasons why bankruptcies have increased so sharply since 1990 is that there has been a lending boom. Now, that boom has benefited some families. It has given them access to credit that they wouldn't have gotten before. But it has also led to abusive and reckless lending by credit card lenders and mortgage lenders in particular, who have targeted the most vulnerable. And what this new law does is the opposite of what Dan's talking about. By making it so difficult to wipe away debt for people who have been targeted by abusive lenders, it's going to encourage the bottom feeders in the lending industry. So the balance now has gone too far the other direction.
I want to thank you all for joining us. Travis Plunkett, Legislative Director of Consumer Federation of America, Dan Mitchell of the Heritage Foundation, and David Harris, Children's Research and Education Institute. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. A very warm welcome back to Elizabeth Press and to all who are observing Ramadan and Rosh Hashanah. We wish you the best. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.